Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Leslie Hurst. Leslie is a multimedia artist with over 30 years of experience who specializes in drawing, painting, and printmaking, creating works in the commercial and fine art sectors. She continues her practice today as an associate professor of experimental and foundation studies at the Rhode Island School of Design. She's also a 2015 Business Accelerator Grant recipient, funding materials, shipping, and transport for her show, Objectively Speaking. Welcome to the show, Leslie. We know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and what you do for a living?
Yes, thanks, Daniel. That was great. I'm perhaps a lucky person in that I'm allowed to let my art be my life. I've been an artist my entire life. I kind of came into the world that way. And I think the most difficult part of figuring that out is what to do with it, how to make your life work around that so that you can discover ways that you work best and that you can make your work most visible to an audience, keep yourself engaged, keep yourself curious. My curiosity is constantly running. I'm a maker at heart. I come from a home, a household of makers. My father was an electrician, and my mom stayed at home. She sewed clothes. So I've always looked at the world as putting together materials and transforming objects with the hand. I found my way into professional practice, first through commercial artwork, and later I turned my focus to direct my attention to the fine art world, and I have been working as a professor as well alongside of that.
Now, Leslie, tell us about your recent solo exhibition. This was what the fund is involved in, called Objectively Speaking. It's an interesting title for, you know, a decidedly visual craft. So why is it called Objectively Speaking, and what can you tell us about it?
I almost feel like the work named itself, whether calling it Objectively Speaking or Speaking Objectively, those two words are what I was particularly interested in, the object, the thingness of our world versus the way that we describe it through language. I'm interested in the philosophy of language and how it affects our cognitive psychology, perception, even our memories. So that's something that we call ontological relativity, you know, the thingness of substance, of thought as substance. And I tried to think about, what if I turn that around? What if I... how can I make the work, the object of the work, speak more about the language that defines it? You know, we're very used to the nature of representation, and now I'm referring to a philosophy that I'm very attuned to, and that is of Ludwig Wittgenstein. Name's a little hard for me to say, but Wittgenstein was interested in the nature of representation and how we understand facts and objects through language, but he considers ways that you can detach objects from their language, and that's exactly what I was trying to do with these works, using material, using shape, using things that we wouldn't even think of as being an object, like the air or the sky, and creating words, combinations of words, language. I'm very influenced as well by authors. And so the work that is in that show was inspired by the writings of the Italian writer Italo Calvino. I think as I read, I see in pictures. As I read, I just understand the world through visual senses. Therefore, the work, as I didn't sit down to necessarily make the work directly for that show, it formed out of my reading and out of my thinking.
Oh, that's fascinating. You know, I'm familiar with Wittgenstein, and of course, he's famous for that quote in his Tractatus, "The world is everything that is the matter," or "the world is everything that is the case." But specifically, if you translate it, "the world is everything that is the matter," it has some interesting implications for visual art and craft. So why is focusing on this materiality of language important to you? Beyond that it comes out of your reading, is there some kind of intrinsic part of it that you feel personally tied to?
Daniel, I think you just made my next show for me, by the way. The world is everything that is the matter. That's great. In fact, the work that was in the Objectively Speaking was actually pulling from the Tractatus as well. And that is, what can be shown cannot be said. You may know that line as well. And I literally recreated that quotation out of nothing at all but objects. That project came to mind while I was on residency in Austria, which is where Wittgenstein is from. I was on residency in Krems, Austria, which is just outside of Vienna. And being on residence there, I'm not in my own studio, I don't have my supplies with me, and I have to think from scratch, you know, just using what's in my environment and trying to decide how is this place defining itself through the way I move through it and the things that I can see here. So I took the objects that were in my studio, in my apartment, and I made heliographs with them. A heliograph is a sun print, so you actually, you know, treat a paper, or in my case, fabric, with a chemical and then put the object on top of it, and basically as if a shadow, an impression of the object, is left behind in the fabric. So I had a sewing machine and a mop and a kickboard, because I'm also a swimmer, say some random items, lots of tools, lots of clamps. And each of these shapes, if you arrange them in a very particular way, can look like letters. So I recreated Wittgenstein's quote, which he made out of language, using nothing at all but the objects in my room.
It's interesting that you're talking about heliographs. We just completed a show just a week ago with Etsuko Ichikawa, who makes pyrographs and aquagraphs. And so to hear this term come out, heliographs, I'm like, yay, this is exciting. So it's a fascinating type of work you're doing with a fascinating sort of philosophical context behind it. What about the show itself? How did the show go?
It was wonderful. And anytime an artist is putting on an exhibition, it can be a bit of a kind of knock on the head to realize, once you get out of your studio space and then into the space of the exhibition, there were plenty of logistics that need to be covered. Hopefully we know that ahead of time. We know the space, the footprint of the gallery. But it was this particular gallery space that led me to think about how I wanted to present the work. It was a sweeping environment that fully skylit. And because of that, it caused a bit of a problem, because some of the work that I created for this exhibition was to be suspended, and I couldn't suspend anything. And now I hear myself turning into the teacher artist, not just the studio artist. As I tell my students, you need to think about presentation as you're thinking about creation, and it's these exact situations that have prompted me to force my thinking into that area. I had to come up with a structuring mechanism to consider the suspension of the works without using the ceiling. So the sky, the works are based upon the sky. Of course, the sky was my collaborator, in essence, if I'm making heliographs. I'm working with the sky and against the sky in this case, trying to think about ways to get my work up there. So I invented a suspension system, which I had worked with a fabricator ahead of time, using the measurements of the gallery. And it was quite a complicated setup, simply because I only had particular areas within the gallery to position the system and to allow the mobility of those who were coming to see the show, not damaging the work, trying to make enough room for everyone to walk through it, to not bump their heads on it, not knock it down. The opening night, to see all of it come together, is a very full opening night. I gave an artist talk. I should have a better count of how many individuals were at the opening, but the gallery was standing room only. We really were finding our way around those mechanisms in a pretty meaningful way, but it was a great exhibition. The Center for Visual Research in Allentown, Pennsylvania, is where the show was held. So it was an academic environment. There were individuals of all ages there, which is really what I work toward in exposing my work. I want to reach the broadest cultural footprint to communicate through my work and to stimulate a new way of seeing. I think, and I was told ahead of time, that many of the individuals who came to see this work might not even have considered it artwork in the sense that they might be more familiar with the traditions of framed work hanging on a wall or sculptural work that's on the floor or on a podium. So to see this work that was created through fabrics, suspended, I also had a light box construction that was a sculptural piece with transparencies, might look like something different to them, but it was a wonderful opening, wonderful conversation. The community of visitors were very involved, wanting to know more about the work and how it was created.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk. There is almost an engineering component to this. So, you know, it really emphasizes the point that to conduct a show, you have to wear a lot of different hats. And so I think that's some of what we'll ask you about. So maybe you can clarify for us. So why did you apply for the Business Accelerator grant of the Clark Hulings Fund? And what were the costs involved that in your show that the grant helped defray specifically?
Indeed, the added exposure from the Clark Hulings Business Accelerator program is wonderful for getting more individuals interested in my work, having my name and images of the work circulating along with the announcement of the show itself. But yeah, you're right. There are all kinds of expenses that move beyond just the materials that go into the work. Transportation becomes an expense. The light box installation is particularly large. It's a stack of custom-made light boxes, and of course that, as a fabrication, is more of an expense than would be, let's say, making drawings. They also are electronic, so I need to have transformers for each of the boxes to keep those going. The wiring becomes a very particular concern, so I needed to work with an electrician to set up the work as I got there. I'm not bad with electricity, but I'm better off, you know, doing the suspended work and moving around the works that were being installed from the ceiling, because they really needed a very particular orientation that required my eye and not just skill. Not that electricity doesn't require a good eye, too. You know, those were some of the considerations. I also had one piece that's a very delicate item, the ones that I've been talking about prior, the hanging fabric pieces and the light box pieces are larger fabrications, but I had one tiny, 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 about the size of a telephone book page. In fact, it's partially constructed on the page of a telephone directory. It's a very fragile paperwork in which I hand-stitched using Venetian lace-making stitches, language, types of language that's built from and had a conversation with the types of information that we were accustomed to see in the old days on telephone directories. Thinking about, you know, the telephone directory, that's like our, like Google. You know, that's Wikipedia. That's how we found our information. That was our search engine. So I'm using very traditional techniques and a more contemporary look at digital languages and the deconstruction of language in this really tiny piece. But I had to figure out a way to also exhibit that very delicate piece. It's not framed. It's a piece that I've also suspended because it's a lace work. I want the front and the back of the artwork to be visible, so something that can be circumnavigated by a viewer. And it also is advantaged by the types of shadows that are created through the lace making. Therefore, I needed to have constructed an acrylic casing to surround this piece to keep people's hands off of it, because it is one of those, just like we can't keep our finger out of the icing of a very beautiful cake, it's one of those kinds of things. I have found that the more beautiful and delicate the work is that I make, the more individuals want to touch it to see what it is. Yeah, this is where some of the expenses came into play and why I knew I needed some help to make this work, you know, to get this work into the exhibition.
Well, all of those parts, I think a lot of people underestimate the sheer amount of materials it takes to do a show, the engineering aspect, the shipping, the transporting of the work, and as you mentioned early on, the marketing promotion side of it, which goes above and beyond just, of course, the money that we provide, et cetera. So, and of course, the idea is to really help move a career farther. So let me ask you the follow-up question. The natural question, of course, is what has this project, including having the funding for it, allowed you to achieve from a career perspective? What's the end bottom line result? If I'm an investor saying, Leslie, I've invested in this because I want to advance the career of an artist, of a working artist, what did I advance? Was it exposure? Did you get more PR, bigger exhibitions, a stronger, wider audience, more of a presence in the gallery scene? What is that investment dollar going for in the end as a bottom line?
You know, like with all works that an artist creates, every work that we create extends into the next thing that we do. We learn from that activity. The work that we are currently doing informs the next project. And in this case, I think what would be most valuable to those who would be willing to invest in my work is to say that, yes, I did it. You know, this, here it is. There is documentation. A successful exhibition took place. You can see that the way that my thinking came together in this exhibition, because of the way that the space was utilized, because of the engagement with the community. If I go on from this point, for instance, to apply for an opportunity to do a public artwork, and I never have created a public artwork. I've never applied for one, and I've never created one. But I would like to. I've realized that is my interest in an audience is, as I've mentioned earlier, reaching a broader cultural spectrum, more ages, more socioeconomic levels, people of different education levels. I really want my work to communicate and to open new ways of seeing and to sensitize individuals to the world that they live in. So I would not be considered eligible for any of these opportunities unless I had a track record. So finding funding for this type of exhibition, even though it's not a public art piece, could really help me to get me on track for that.
I really like what you're pointing out. You know, the other day I was looking online about what it takes to be a listed artist. You know, you see this phrase a lot at various auction houses. And, inevitably, so you think, listed artist, what does that mean, really? And in the old days, there were actual books, you know, who's who of various artists. And there were three or four different books that if you appeared in there, and there were accounts of recent sales and exhibitions and, you know, sort of what your work sold for, and you have a bio, you were a listed artist. And it gave collectors more confidence, and it gave other people more confidence in buying your work, etc., and in giving you further gigs. And a lot of that has really moved online. You know, now there are four or five websites instead of four or five books that, you know, it's amazing how many artists don't appear there because they simply haven't filled out a form. I think the most difficult website says, well, yeah, we make you actually mail in a paper form. But how hard is that, right? And so part of it is, you know, what's on that form is what shows have you done? What exhibitions have you done? What dates were they done? Where were they? Who sponsored that exhibition? Has any of your work sold at auction? What did it sell for? What's your bio? Tell us about yourself. You know, give us some idea of why you paint and how you paint, or why you create sculpture and how you create sculpture, and so on. It's gratifying to hear you talk about this, that, you know, the bottom line for you is partly creating a track record that makes you eligible to move on and do other things in your career trajectory, such as perhaps get your first commissioned public work, which is a great call out. So I want to ask you about this exhibition as it relates to your previous exhibition. So I have basically a couple more questions in sort of exploring your recent project before we move on to business strategy. The question is this. You had a solo show in Italy, and that was entitled Message Threads. And you carried some of the works from that show into this show and, you know, sort of based this exhibition off of that solo show. So my question is, you know, why did you do that? And why do these two shows have such similar works and a similar theme? What is the point of continuity? And I sort of have a follow-up question to that as well.
Yeah, and it does stem from what I said earlier about every work that we make is informing the next work. Do we even put a break in between those? You know, I consider I've just been doing one thing my entire life, and it just keeps taking different forms as my space in the world changes or my resources change. But indeed, thank you so much for mentioning my summer show last year at the Museo del Merletto. The Message Threads exhibition was also built from readings of another of my favorite authors, Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian poet and novelist. And I particularly drawn to his short essay, The Library of Babel, and the fact that, you know, all knowledge, he writes about all knowledge being contained in this endless library, and in fact, by the time we get to that much information, it becomes total gibberish, that there's no way of quantifying or even organizing that much information. And in a way, that's a reflection of our current internet system, which is messy, impossible to diffuse. I was working there, that's when I began working with Leif, was to develop the works for that show, and thinking about the relationship between lace and digital code. If you look at a pattern for lace making, it looks identical to JavaScript. It's just zeros and ones. So they're completely related, as is all textile work is built upon the same systems that we create digital code with. It was the first time for me working in that way, and my reasons for working in that manner were not simply because I was in my own studio space thinking about whatever was at hand, but because I was thinking again about the space where the work would be shown, who my audience would be, and what would be my restrictions of the space. And interestingly, the Objectively Speaking exhibition, I couldn't hang anything from the ceiling. In the Message Threads exhibition, I was not allowed to hang anything on the walls. The museum space is an 11th century palazzo in Burano, Italy, and the frescoed walls couldn't put a nail through them, but I could hang things from the ceiling. And that was when I began working with these suspended lace works. So it was a logistical problem that I was trying to circumnavigate in order to figure out how to create something that would make sense in the space. And as I mentioned, too, the small, delicate piece that I had in the Objectively Speaking show was one of the works that came from the Burano show, the Message Threads exhibition. And it was wonderful that the lineage of those two exhibitions taking place 1 year apart from one another was completely evident. It didn't look like something that came from, you know, outside of the framework of the works created with the sky, because it was also suspended from the air and utilizing the negative space between the lace or the sky as a physical formal element of the artwork.
Well, Leslie, I want to ask you, so there's some continuity between the two shows. Does that help you build sort of a brand identity and awareness to do that? Is that something you plan to persist in, or was it unintentional? And sort of how do you help yourself build a stronger brand identity across multiple exhibitions like this?
As an artist who thinks, as we all are, we are ourselves. My thinking and my understanding of the world comes from a variety of sources that are uniquely me, and they will never be dissolved by, you know, any external force. They might be influenced or redirected, but I will always be one who sees the world through a physicality of language, kind of bringing the tactile breathing presence of experience into play through language. My previous work in commercial art prior to my focus on fine art was in graphic design and specifically in typography. So I believe that interest in language and letter forms began there, you know, how letters begin to speak as something other than just the word, the signifier, but begin to be a mark of their own. So I suppose a way of answering your question might be to say that, yes, I think that that's always going to be evident in my work. To me, there's a very strong personal characteristic in my work, that there's often an obsessive quality in the work. I'm very interested in small interconnected forms and the way that those forms actually begin to talk about it. The fiber of text on a page, if you'd like to think of it that way, language, cities, maps, building, all of these are references in my work. So yes, I believe that someone going into a space would recognize the works that I make as things that are uniquely mine.
So there's an internal component of the branding, which is sort of your understanding of the world. As you said, it comes from a variety of sources. We mentioned Wittgenstein earlier. And then there's an external component, those strong characteristics, strong personal characteristics of the work, which you've taken from typography and forms of language. So that's interesting that you're focused on carrying that branding through the trajectory of various exhibitions. That's so important in any line of work, of course, any career path. I want to ask you about one more sort of off the topic, synesthesia. You mentioned it before the show. You said something about teaching the class on it. I'm like, whoa, hold that thought. I want to ask you about it during the show. I know what that is, but you know, maybe not everyone does. So can you tell us what is synesthesia and what do you have to do with that topic?
That's great. I am personally not a synesthete. Synesthesia is a crossing of the senses, and that may be when an individual tastes or sees color or hears color, so they're actually swapping senses. And although I don't personally experience synesthesia, at least not in a pronounced way, I think that maybe I do as much as any artist does. We have to be very aware of our senses, how we interpret sound and how we allow temperature to color our thinking, for instance. I do, in my teaching and in my own art making, tap into that as a resource from time to time. All art makers have ways of, I don't know if it would be getting themselves out of a rut, but it might even be getting started with a new project or a following an idea and allowing the process to take you somewhere. And we set little obstacles or problems for ourselves, and some of those might be a kind of exercise that take place in the studio. We might think about ways that color or form are described by listening to music. Many well-known artists have used music, for instance, as a source for creating compositions and creating their artworks, even though they also claim not to be synesthetes, but simply interpreters.
Yeah, so synesthesia, the sort of ability to cross, not the ability, but crossing perceptual pathways so that you could hear a color or see a sound, etc. You teach a course related to this, or you teach your students about this?
I teach quite a bit about color. I teach experimental and foundation studies. The majority of my students for the past decade have been first-year art and design students. And color remains a very important component to that teaching for me as both an artist and a professor of art and design. So I like to expose them to ideas beyond what might be traditionally thought of as color theories. I put a plural on that because the most important thing for them to learn is that there is no one such thing as a color theory. Color behaves in a wide array of manners depending on its source material, pigmentation, and philosophy, what we're applying it to. So synesthesia is just one of the things that we tap on. And I look for ways to allow students to see commonalities in their understanding of color and form. So one of the exercises that I do is I ask them to think about a sound that everyone might know, you know, a very prescribed sound. And that would be something like a logo. You know, would there be a sound logo? And I will look to one of my heroes for some help here, and that's Joseph Albers, the Bauhaus artist, who was a master at both art making and at teaching of color. And Albers had created a color exercise, a color composition that was based on the NBC logo. And you and I can both know what that sounds like, right? We can sing that. I'm not going to do it now, but maybe you have a recording of it. But my students, even at this age, you know, in 2016, they still understand that NBC logo, so it's still something that's broadcast to them and familiar to them. And they can see how it plays out in the high note, let's see, how does it start? Mid note, high note, low note, through color and compositional formation.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit, Leslie, about business strategy, which is sort of the core of our show today. business strategy for the working artist. But before then, I want to mention that the Clark Hulings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. So share this commitment with us now at clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Leslie, you have an interesting background. Prior to becoming a professor and artist, you owned your own graphic studio. Has owning your own business influenced the way that you engage with your art as a business and as a career now?
I'm sure that it has. I've never quite thought of it in that way, although I have found that the two areas of work are much more similar than they are different, as you might be very well aware. When I made the decision to leave my graphic design business and to go on to pursue a career as a fine artist, I was not particularly aware of the problems that I would be encountering along the way. It was a very difficult thing to do, mostly because of the time in my life that took place. I no longer had the community resources that perhaps a beginning fine artist would have. I was leaving a successful business, and the collaborations, the partnerships, the suppliers, the clientele that I had really didn't transfer into the other area. Plus, the areas that I needed to go to continue that course of study were not within the community that I had built where my business was located. So it really involved quite a lot of transitions in my life that I wasn't quite prepared for. I guess I knew, we all know that must take place, but it's not until you start taking those steps that you realize how many things you are walking both away from and into as these transitions take place. It's not like you can just sort of start a little painting on the side there and slowly let your focus turn in that direction. It really does require quite a deliberate jumping off and starting over again. And because I had done that to begin with, beginning my graphic design business, I was quite young at the time. I was 25 years old. I had worked professionally as an art director for 5 years at that time and had built a strong clientele. I knew how to present myself and to present my work, and I knew the importance of finding work that I was good at doing. You know, how do I promote myself and my work the best way that I could? So, yes, indeed, I do find now that in my fine art practice, I do draw from a lot of that experience. My profession as a scholar and a professor of art and design is different, however. That is a really very different environment. So I kind of feel like a two-headed monster most of the time.
Well, I think you have learned some really key things that even if they're not sort of consciously learned, they're certainly coming out in the way you talk about your art business and what you say. You know, of course, the Clark Hulings Fund is currently teaching the Business Accelerator Workshop Series, where we teach business processes and skills to artists so they can sort of become self-sustaining and manage their business. And, you know, you're talking right now about something very near and dear to our heart that we're also talking about, which is learning about the supply chain. You know, you brought up the first thing you mentioned when I asked you about your sort of previous career is contacts. And we're focused on the notion of contacts being central. And of course, you immediately segmented those into suppliers and clientele and potential partners. And that may seem very simple, but those are critical modes of thinking to understand that and be able to sort of implement how that works with the purpose of growing. So I hear that in what you're saying. And I also hear something else that's really important. You know, there are a lot of people out there that are working in some kind of full-time employment environment, and they're doing the side hustle. They've got some kind of gig or job or art practice on the side, you know, essentially moonlighting. And at some point, there comes a time to pivot where you're thinking about taking the plunge. And you did it. You took the plunge into starting your own business. And part of what I heard you say is that having done that once, when you then sort of left doing your own business to pursue an art career and an art teaching career, you were already sort of used to taking that kind of plunge.
And so there's almost a skill set that you learn and a way of thinking about problems, and there's also an emotional skill set that you learn that you describe. So I actually think that for someone who says, I'm not really sure, I haven't thought about it, that's good. There's a lot that you're sort of telling us that's latent there that, you know, a lot of us can hear. That makes me want to ask you, so why exactly did you leave the graphic design business in the first place? You pursue a full-time art career. Why did you leave?
Yeah, that is a great question, and it almost needs to go back even earlier than that. Why did I even enter into a commercial art profession in the first place, rather than a fine art profession? In that I had known from a very, very young age that I was extremely skilled in art making. As I mentioned, I grew up in a blue collar family, and I wasn't very exposed to artwork. This sounds extremely naive, but I don't know that I even realized that there were contemporary individuals, people walking the earth with me, who were making artwork. That to me, artwork was something you saw in museums, and it felt very remote. And I never really imagined myself as taking place in that lineage. So when I began pursuing ways to make a living through my art making and through my gifts, I always have trouble using that word, but that definitely were. I just have that capacity. I entered into commercial art and enjoyed it very much, but I'm talking now about the early 1980s. And at that time, even in commercial art making, in graphic design and in advertising design, the work was very much based on the hand. And even though our tools have now changed drastically, you know, it wasn't long after that that the primary tool in graphic design became digital, became the computer. I was using tools to begin with, photographic equipment, you know, pencils, magic markers, pens, pen and ink. Even though I've always been, the profession has always required a sense of tools, it's the sense of movement in the use of those tools that I believe I really began missing, that working digitally didn't really require you to leave your seat. It required a very similar kind of action from the fingers, from the arms, from the body. Whether or not I was doing my taxes or doing accounting, it would be a pretty similar movement, whereas the earlier movements were much more expressive and caused a lot of movement through the room. The thinking changed just a little bit with the onset of the digital applications, as did the working hierarchies. As an art director, I was the one coming up with the ideas and creating layouts, which were very much like creating works of art, often using markers or my drawing skills to create those layouts. And with the onset of the digital, the production of the work also became a part of the job of the art director. And they just weren't really things that interested me as much anymore, or whether or not they interested me, I felt that I had skills and capacities and vision that was beyond what someone could learn to do with the digital applications. So I was really driven to just begin working on my own and creating my own problems to be solved, and found that within 1 year's time of starting to concentrate on studio work, I had a work accepted into a museum exhibition. And I thought, well, you know, this, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this world is. It's not been a part of my practice, of my profession, of my thinking, but I want to know what it is. So I took a couple of years gathering up speed and closed the business and sold my home and used that money to put myself back in school.
Well, now, graphic design and advertising, those are all about sort of communicating a message as well. And you talked largely about the tools, but does that inherent need to communicate with the audience, does that continue to influence your art, or is there some kind of key difference between how graphic design and advertising reach an audience and how art does, or your art does?
I see them as being the same, except that my purpose is not to sell them something. My purpose is to open eyes, to open an understanding of the world, to initiate a way of seeing the world that perhaps has never been considered before. One could say that certain forms of very effective advertising do exactly the same thing, and it was for that reason that I so enjoyed working in that area. I mean, I still love great graphic design and great advertising design. It is something that appeals to me very much, but I believe now that, you know, removing myself from that is an underlying purpose in my work, and really expressing the nuances of what it means to be a human in this world. Those are the things that drive me, and that's what I think about when I'm in my studio.
Well, now, many artists have had to be inventors. You know, you can think about, obviously, Da Vinci, in order to accomplish their vision. And we talked about earlier you almost having to be an engineer to accomplish yours. But for one of your recent pieces, a piece called Dumpster, you had to create your own framing system. Can you tell us a little bit about that process and what you learned from it?
Yeah, this was going back to the work that was at the Museo del Maletto in Burano, and the fact that I couldn't use the walls. So that was a really complicated thing to work with. The drawing itself couldn't be sandwiched between components, so it couldn't have glass on the front of it because the inks sat on top of the surface of the vellum in a way that they would smear or become damaged. And then how do you get that floating thing to suspend itself within the room? I began experimenting with materials, purchasing small items from exhibition companies, little grommets, crafting my own plexiglass divots and slicing them down in different widths and drilling holes, just anything that I could think of to create this system that would snap together around the artwork to allow the artwork to be suspended freely, but to also give it enough strength and protection from the viewing, the audience who would be moving around the work.
Well, you know, that's a hardware lover's dream. You know, I grew up walking around with my grandfather picking up every nut and bolt and grommet and other and wing nut off of the ground when we would sort of take our walks. And in his garage, he would have this enormous set of Craftsman little plastic trays. You'd have all your little things in there he picked up. And sooner or later, you know, I grew up able to fix my car just by going out to the garage and taking one of the pop tops or the Bic pen caps or something there and using it, wrapping some wire around it. You know, when you're poor, you have to innovate. And I hear this innovation that you've done. I almost think that your next exhibition ought to be called Little Grommets and Plexiglass Divots because, you know, it gets guys like me excited. Wow, there's going to be hardware. That's pretty fun. You know, the art, that's great. I came to see the hardware. But that's funny. And then you play this other role. You know, you're inventor, you're engineer, you're artist, but you're also teacher. So how about this? How do you juggle being a professor with making your artwork and also maintaining all this administrative side of your art as a business? For instance, applying for the grants, you applied for the Clark Healing Fund grant, your fellowships, the inventorying your artwork, all of these things. How do you juggle being a professor with doing that?
I think what I'd most like to do now is to draw you a picture of it, and I wish that we could do that on this podcast. But I'm certain that I am a monster with a lot of heads.
You're saying with words we could draw a picture of anything, so I'm waiting with eagerly. I'm ready. The words are all it is.
That's great. Yes, I am a many-headed monster. I'm not very adaptable when it comes to hat changing. I find that my focus is extremely deep in whatever area I am currently involved with. So unlike a lot of professors of art in particular who might carve out one or two days per week within between classes to spend in their studio, I have a little bit of trouble doing that. So I really find that I need to segment my time to make very strict barriers around my time in the summer and during the winter session, where I teach at the Rhode Island School of Design. We have a session in the winter that's a little bit longer than most winter breaks of most universities. So, you know, those are times that I really need to be secluded in my own head to understand my own work. During the period of time when I'm teaching, because it's much more about bringing together content, administrative work, I find that that can be a time when I'm also administrator in my artwork, in my professional practice with my artwork. But it's definitely not a creative time for me. I need a lot of space to do that stuff. Headspace is what I mean.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about the sort of professor role, because there's some other aspects of it. You know, I'm curious, what has being a professor done to your studio practice, not just on the time side of it, but in terms of your ability to sustain a working business in terms of managing all the logistics? And yet you're sort of in it for good or ill, right? Because some tenured professors are required to have their own professional practice as an artist, and I think that's the case for you as well, right?
Yes, that is the case, and it is, it's a double-edged sword. I am devoted to teaching. I'm devoted to what I can help to facilitate with young artists and designers who are really struggling with ways to find their own voice and to find not only the things that they're good at, but ways that they can keep themselves interested through their own kind of problem solving. Each of us enters into this world of art with very particular characteristics, whatever spawned those interests. Maybe they were because of a love of comic books, or like in my case, it was watching my dad put together little transistors for the electronic boards and stereo equipment. Whatever those interests are, you know, how do you make that viable? How do you follow that and continue to see possibilities in it and to trust in the experience? You know, you had mentioned earlier that maybe I'd gotten used to the process of moving forward, or, you know, beginning a new way of working when I left my graphic design business and went back to school, that perhaps that was something that you get used to, but you never get used to it, but you can learn to trust it. You can learn to trust how horrible it feels to not know what you're doing and to just realize that you have very strong convictions and, you know, very planted capabilities and ideas about how you see yourself working in the world, and do make it work. With teaching, it did begin as the way for me to afford my work as an artist, because I do not make an income from the artwork that I create. I would love to. I would love to have collectors taking hold of my work, but I would not want to be beholden to that, so that the work that I created became a type of an expected product. I feel like that would interest me no more than my commercial work had interested me, that I needed to leave that at some point, because I'm much more curious about the directions that it's going to be pulling me, and I want to follow those directions. So the longer that I have been teaching, and it's now been 16 years as a professor, and I can't believe that, I've realized that it helps me in the studio at the same time, that I think that I'm a smarter teacher than I am an artist, that I hear myself saying things to students that I forget to tell myself in the studio, and then I remember, I don't do that when I'm in my studio. I need to remember that, yes, to begin to understand when something isn't working and to go back and start over again. You know, those are things that we forget to do as practitioners, and students don't think about doing that. But as a teacher, I can see a student doing that and guide them through that process.
You know, I wonder, though, being an instructor helped or hindered your career really as a working artist? In the end result, or if we summed it all up, good or bad for your career?
That is such a hard thing to say. It really is. How can we not be the person who we are? That there's no way of putting the Leslie who's not a teacher next to the Leslie who is one. That I don't have that comparison to know which part of me has been fueled from that teaching. It's a very good question, and I would like to have more time in the studio. That's true. I definitely need more time in the studio. I don't know. I can't really answer that.
Well, I think that was the answer, you know, for you and for I think a lot of people. I don't think you're alone in that. I think it's important that you called it out, You know, that not everything is a what if, not everything is a logistical choice, you know, because some of the things you pointed out are so emphasizing logistics, and this is not one of them. The professorship requires you to do the art as part of the professorship, and the person that you are requires you to do the professorship. So I think, you know, you laid out two key points early on. I sort of asked you what the components of branding are for you, and you really described an internal component. You know, your understanding of the world drives you, and this is part of that internal motivation and understanding of the world. And, you know, it's partly your understanding, your self-understanding as well. And then there's the external component you described, which is, you know, comes out in the strong personal characteristics of your work. So I don't think this question is so different from asking, you know, who are you versus what is your brand? Let me then ask you how you deal with it on the output side. So how do you balance creating works that intrigue you, but also still producing works that are profitable?
If I knew that, I don't know that I'm creating works that are profitable. I don't know that I would fit into that category. I have the capacity of doing that, if that was what I chose to do, to make work for a buying market. It has been something that I've tried not to do directly, to make myself, as an art maker, the profit point, I suppose, would be a way of looking at that. You know, how can I continue making work that isn't so much about an end product or about something that's maybe going to go and live in a private collection somewhere? Because I am much more drawn to that larger level of engagement and communication that comes from the dialogue that occurs in an exhibition or in a public presentation. And that is something that teaching also adds to, because I do lecture and I attend conferences, and I am able to hear about art movements and engage in art exhibitions that I may not have access to travel to under other circumstances. So in a way, my level of exposure is really opened up there. But as you mentioned, and as I mentioned, it does keep me out of the studio. And how do we work best? At what point do you draw the line between the inspiration and the input for the work and actually the nuts and bolts of doing the work? And I'll kind of answer that as I'm asking it and say that the only way that we will get better at what we do is to do it, just to do it. So being in the studio definitely that's a dream for me. That dream doesn't eliminate my teaching. But finding a way to balance those things a little bit better is meaningful to me. And I wish I had the magic pill for it.
Well, I can't help but want to ask you a little bit about marketing strategy in the third and final part of our show. I want to ask you, you know, you work in multiple media. And in a way, that may be diversifying your message, your product. I want to know first, do you think it waters down your overall brand at all to work in multiple media? And then secondly, do you think that there's still a stigma associated with this, with crossing media? You know, I've seen a lot of people involved in printmaking or mixed media collage work or muralists who are crossing over into sort of the fine art realm, the fine art version of their work, and they're mixing media unrelentingly and unself-consciously. And some of them have expressed sort of facing these two hurdles. One, potentially watering down their brand, because if you're only producing one kind of work, it's really easy to pigeonhole you and therefore to brand you and categorize you and know what to sell your work as. If you're producing multiple kinds, it's hard, it's more of a challenge. And then the other is sort of the stigma, the social stigma within the art world of being a multimedia artist. Do you face either of those twin challenges?
Yeah, humorously, I feel like there are still other avenues that I'd like to add to my work. I would like to get involved with movement, actually incorporating forms of dance and movement in my work. Part of my teaching extends into that area, so that's an area that I want to bring into my personal practice. And that could extend into animation. And I didn't mention to you earlier as well that I'm also an artist bookmaker. So I have many different ways of expressing myself. And in today's art world, that's a commonality. Here again, the brand is not so much my work as it is me, my thinking, following the thread of my philosophies, of the processes that the work is demanding me to follow along. So no, I don't see those as being problems at all.
Wow. You know, another way to define a problem, you know, the cliche is a problem is an opportunity, but I think your perspective on it sort of transforms it from a problem for you into you know, something more of an adventure. So that's really refreshing to hear. Let me ask you a related question, though. So you're philosophical. I want to ask you a philosophical question. So as an artist, what makes an object fine art? What exactly, at what point is it fine art?
That's in the viewer's mind, I would suppose. It's a question that I ask my students. And as I hear you asking me, I'm imagining some of the answers that I receive from the students. And what I ultimately bring back to them is the heightening of everyday experience. That is the definition of a work of art. To me, what is the difference between a rock that you stub your toe on and a rock that may be presented in David Hammond's work, for instance? What is the difference between these two pieces of work? And it is the heightening of that everyday experience through placement, through context.
That's really fun. You ask you a philosophical question, you get a philosophical answer, of course. Ah, that's great. All right, so let me ask you a more concrete question then. You know, you've had this really awesome and interesting access to the different worlds of commercial art, fine art, art instruction. And so, you know, technology has been a great part of your background. You referred earlier, you know, to JavaScript and binary coding and that sort of thing. You know tech a little bit. And so why train yourself to do art in an analog or manual way when you could use computers and digital? And conversely, does that experience you have in computers and digital, does it help you with traditional and analog creation?
I think it helps incredibly. I feel very fortunate to have grown up at the time that I have, to have begun outside of the digital realm and then learned to work digitally through analog practices, because now as I go back in the other direction, I have a deeper understanding of the way that these two areas talk to one another. One of the examples that I like to give is that, for instance, something that we all have pretty easy and open access with is working with Photoshop. And I've never been trained on any kinds of applications with Photoshop, but I'm better at it than anyone I know because I'm a painter. And I have learned how to use the pixels in ways that override the programming, you know, how the actual application was programmed. I don't like to use any of the menu items. I really work in ways outside of that to use my painting skills through these applications. And I don't think I would understand how to do that had I not come from the analog, the hand processes first. So yes, I feel very fortunate to be moving back and forth through those worlds. I remember when I had my graphic design business, I had interviewed a young artist for a position, and they were looking through my portfolio and some of my typographic designs and were all struck by the work and knew that I had designed all of it by hand. And the question was, how did you do this by hand? And the question sounded, you know, so simple to me because it's second nature to use the types of drawing tools and the skills that I was very accustomed to applying, using French curves, you know, old boat curves. I probably look like Leonardo designing my type at that time. But, I'm very happy for that kind of experience.
So just a couple more questions about this before we wind down with fun questions. So for your art show, how do you manage your own promotion and your audience engagement for the show you did and for upcoming shows? You know, how do you take on PR, social, email, getting signups at the event? What do you do to manage that stuff?
I sure could use help in all of those areas. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I do what I can to make announcements through my personal mailing list that I keep. I use MailChimp, and that allows me to customize to a pretty good degree the type of information and the visualization of my announcements. But I really need a lot of help in that area. That is my weakest link in my professional practice as an artist and as a professor, as a scholar, everything.
Well, I think you're not alone. You know, I just got through delivering the Business Accelerator workshop on digital marketing for the artists who participate in that within our program. And one of the reasons I ask that question is extremely common. And, you know, we sort of laid out together an effective, like, streamlined strategy, how to get most bang for your buck with as few changes to your life and sort of studio time as possible. And it all centered around sort of the events, the maintaining the mailing list, and social and PR. And so I think you're, even if you're not quite there yet, you're still on the money, because it really starts with that mailing list. So I'm really glad to hear that you're maintaining one. And then it's just about strategy from then on out. So I have a couple of questions. You know, Leslie, recently you asked me some questions about marketing strategy, and you and I haven't had a chance to connect over those since that conversation. And I wonder if you're interested in me taking a stab at a couple of those right now while we're in the call for the
Yes, and I'll try to tap back into some of what I had asked you.
I actually wrote it down.
Oh, good. Let's try then. Go ahead.
So I'll tell you what the question is I have and just sort of confirm it with you and make sure this is what, you know, that I captured it right. And then maybe I'll take a stab at it and give people maybe just a little bit of taste. Of course, it's not the same as being in one of our accelerator courses or something like that, but maybe give them a taste of what it's like going through that program and being in this stuff. So you had asked, as I recall, how to overcome things like the social clique of art promotion. So there are doors that don't open based on the prevailing winds of taste making, art fashion, prevalent styles, biases about genre, and other things. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I got it. Yay. I got it spot on. That's great. So, you know, what I'll say about that, and this is, may seem a little bit light and fluffy because this isn't really a webinar or a course, so we can't get down to super concrete details, but you're not alone in asking that. And a lot of our course participants asked it. And what we talked about is the critical need for each working artist to develop a portable, thriving, independent audience of enthusiastic fans, independently of any representation they have. So what we discovered is that a lot of artists are actually relying utterly on their gallery to do a lot of their marketing, or relying on some other third party, an agent of some kind, to maintain the mailing list and sort of take care of them. And so you, of course, have taken the first step. You're using MailChimp, which is great, highly recommend it, you know, as a free tool. You're maintaining a mailing list and sending out updates. And so what we sort of designed is a system where artists are actually responsible for getting the signups at any of their shows or exhibitions. Those names and email addresses are absolutely mission critical. They're central to any really effective marketing program. But then not just immediately dumping those into MailChimp or an email software, but instead having a buffer, some kind of contact management system. We recommended Google Contacts simply because it's free and it talks to everything. So if you want to reach out and invite people to your Facebook page, for instance, you can go in and it will pull contacts right out of your Google Contacts. If you don't have a MailChimp or another newsletter type of account, you can log in and create one in just a few minutes and tell it to reach out and pull your contacts from Google. You can do this in nearly any social media or marketing platform. They all sort of interact with Google. Having that extra buffer of creating a contact management system, then an email system, and making sure that the gallery is not the only one getting that list, that ultimately you're responsible for getting your own list, that's hugely part of it. And then the fourth component is just sort of maintaining a regular calendar of independent events, things that aren't just set up for you by another person and don't just have to do with an exhibition, but, you know, micro events, little demonstrations, little charity acts, little public teachings, little collaborative art works, little studio tours, etc. Things that provide an ongoing amount of content. And what you get out of that is you get these happenings that are happening, and you get these people on a list that you can alert, and then you lock in the last piece, which is maintaining your social media channels. Pick two or three that you like, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever it is, Instagram, and sharing what you're doing. Maybe a daily post about you, what you're doing in the studio. This is what my challenges are today. I'm inventing a new framing system. I'm figuring out how to hang something. This is my current show. Here's an event we're doing. You know, something at least a few times a week that sort of keep you top of mind and tell the story of you. And it begins to build a thriving audience that shares your stuff. So the key point is you can't get past the clique. You can't get past that genre bias unless you have an independent mailing list, a thriving audience that you build yourself, and some kind of content and events that you can use to inspire and develop that audience's interest in you as a professional. I found your question really prescient because it was the same question that almost every single member of our accelerator program asked. And then the other question that I had down for you, I just had one other. You asked me how much of what we do should be marketing time versus studio time, given that a busy artist like yourself who also teaches and so on can barely find time to clear one's head. Is that an accurate portrayal of your question, or did you have a clarification about that?
Yeah, and I would hands down say that is the greatest problem and concern for anyone working as a studio practitioner today, and probably for all of time, is how do you balance making the work and actually finding a place for the work to live in the world? Because they are very different measures. They are very different avenues to follow. And the head that is the mind, when I say the mind and the soul and the spirit of the artist that is creating work that is truly transitory and is defining the world and presenting the world in ways that are not predictable and not every day, is a mind that needs a lot of space and a lot of time to itself, which is not at all what promotion is about. They are different beings altogether. And generally, artists don't possess both of those heads. Jeff Koons is one that we will put in a different category for many reasons, but in general, for an artist to have the time to really begin to understand their work, they're not thinking about how it grows its legs and goes out into the world. I mean, in many respects, that's quite the opposite of what a parent would do with their child when they know that the child is eventually, you know, they're working on something that's going to go out and live in the world. It may be that I work even more as a kind of an outsider artist in that regard, because I am so insular in my thinking that it's often difficult for me to put myself back into that marketing head. So that's why that marketing frame of mind exists much more with my teacher self, my professor self, than it does with my creative self.
I think that core difference is something I agree with. You know, it's not so much like changing hats. It's more like taking off a hat and putting on a helmet. It's a different mindset. And so, great. So we've illustrated the problem. And so I do want to say something then about the challenge. And again, this is sort of where we change roles and the interviewer becomes the interviewee, et cetera. And so here's what we've been talking about in the Business Accelerator courses. You know, we've talked about the fact that marketing has to be clear your head time. That instead of having this dichotomy between, wow, you know, I got studio time, I've got clear my head time, and then I've got very little left over to run my business. Marketing really shouldn't be, and the business activities in general, but marketing in particular, shouldn't be at odds with your process. It should be part of the process. And so we've discussed how marketing amplifies studio time. And we've talked about it in terms of marketing is where you vent. Marketing is where you cultivate mindfulness. It's really important. You know, we have studio time could be venting and can be about mindfulness too, but humans need more than one kind of each. You know, we need to give space to the part of our brain that creates so that when we come back to it, it's able to do that. And that kind of space is an outlet. And so often marketing, for instance, and promotion is viewed as sort of a sordid business that we sort of do, you know, independently. It's an add-on. And so the way we've been portraying it is the events, the email, the social activities that we do are a place for that frenetic energy that builds up alongside the impetus to create, a place for that energy to actually go. And that being, sitting down and sort of being quiet with one's marketing and becoming sort of self-aware with it and expressing some of those things that are latent and alongside that creative energy, that makes us more mindful and actually gives us better ideas in the studio. And so, yeah, I'm really glad that you brought those questions to my attention. They weren't part of our show. They were part of an earlier conversation we had, you know, about sort of the program that we're developing. And your insights into the problems, Leslie, faced by working artists were seminal in helping us develop course material. So I really wanted to thank you for that and tell you how valuable it has been to the various students going through those courses and sort of give you some insights into what we did with it and where we took it and where it went. So Leslie, thank you for that.
Wow, that's exciting to hear, and I can only say that it's something that I share with many of my artist friends so frequently, that it's an ongoing problem. It's what we juggle with, our multiple selves, as we try to walk the life and live the existence of a creative individual and to find a way of making that actually happen, to make a viable living from it.
So I just want to mention to the audience, you know, these are the kinds of ordinary business challenges the Clark Ewlings Fund teaches working artists to overcome in our Business Accelerator program. So to learn more about the mission of the Clark Ewlings Fund, visit clarkewlingsfund.org. And if you found value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. You can do that at clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. To continue bringing content like this to the public, visit clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Leslie, one fun question to wind down the hour. And I have my sort of evil laugh hat on now. I'm thinking, you know, because this is where we take you back in time. If you could go back at the beginning of everything, when you first got interested in producing art, etc., and do one thing differently, what would that be?
Oh my gosh, what a big question. What would I do differently? How much time do I have to think about this? The answer that I had much earlier about refocusing my direction at a much later time in my life, if I had any idea how difficult that was going to be, I would have set a different kind of a support structure, and that would be a community structure around myself. But you're even talking about way, way earlier than that. I think I would have tried to get myself adopted by some family that would take me to museums every week. I currently have students right now who were bored to tears because their parents drug them to museums all over the world constantly. And that, as a resource, was completely gone from my life. I think I only ever went to the Museum of Natural History in Philadelphia when I was a brownie, a Girl Scout. I don't know how old that is, but it's pretty young. And that experience is indelible. I remember the spaces, the spectacle, the objects, the beauty of that world was so tantalizing and fascinating to me. And, you know, I really didn't have the wherewithal, the knowledge of how to make that more of my reality. It was a splendor that wasn't a part of my regular life, so I didn't know that there were ways to maybe saturate that experience a little bit more. But there is no such thing as stepping in that water again.
I like that answer. You know, I was one of those people dragged to museums and bored out of my socks every single time. Up until relatively recently in life, when through enough interaction with artists and collectors, I got interested in the art, and more specifically, not liking art because I'm supposed to like that art, you know? Oh, it's a Gauguin. I'm supposed to look at it and go, ooh and ah, and I'm, or a Rothko, and I don't get it. I'm sorry, I don't get it. But instead, figuring out who I like and going, wow, they got Magritte. I got to get in there. What's the admission? Here, just take my ticket. Here, here's my card. I'm going to go in. Where's the Magritte? You know, that turns me on. The ability to figure out that you find your own way in loving art in the same way you find your own way in creating art. That's been key for me. I wish younger students had more of a chance to sort of do that, you know. So I love that you're talking about going back and going into that exploratory mode again. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Leslie Hurst, visit lesliehurst.com. I'm going to spell that for you as Leslie, H-I-R-S-T.com. That's Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E-H-I-R-S-T.com. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Leslie. It's been really great having you.
Thank you so much, Daniel. This was really a lot of fun. I enjoyed our conversation.